Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It was a historic, if possibly disheartening, moment this week in Israel's elections. After a campaign that appeared to be setting up for a broad referendum on changes in leadership and approach by Israel to its economic future and its vision of national security, in the end, it was a vote for the status quo. Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party were the victors. A large number of Israelis polled said they couldn't imagine anyone besides Benjamin Netanyahu running the country, and Netanyahu, it appears, can't imagine holding a coalition government together that will realistically pursue peace with a Palestinian state.
Anyone who is going to establish a Palestinian state, anyone who is going to evacuate territories today is simply giving a base for attacks to radical Islam against Israel. This is the true reality that was created here in the last few years. They who do not understand that stick their heads in the sand. The left are doing it, sticking their head in the sand, time and time again.
So if you are prime minister, a Palestinian state will not be formed?
Indeed.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking to NRG News and saying if there is to be a Palestinian state, it will not be while he is in office. Is peace between Israel and a Palestinian state politically untenable? Are the Palestinians so divided that no plausible coalition of Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian National Authority in the West Bank can deliver a viable peace deal in the foreseeable future? Are we once again waiting for some brutal war to reset the deck in what constitutes the Middle East peace process? Joining me now is George Mitchell, who served as President Obama's envoy to the Middle East from 2009 to 2011. Senator Mitchell, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your assessment of the elections straight off the top here? Where do you think we stand right now?
Well, first off, Israel is a democracy, a friend and ally of the United States, and I think we should respect the democratic process. And, of course, we will deal with the government that the people of Israel have freely and fairly chosen to represent them. At the same time, the Prime Minister's statement regarding Palestinian statehood makes that much more difficult, because that's not just an Obama policy. That has been an American policy for a very long time. Indeed, perhaps the most eloquent and forceful and persuasive statement of the importance of a two-state solution to Israel's security, I emphasize to Israel's security, was made by former President George W. Bush in a speech he gave in Jerusalem in January of 2009. So I think the Palestinians now feel vindicated. When the Prime Minister Netanyahu made his speech at Bar-Ilan University in June of 2009, saying that he favored a two-state solution, the Palestinians and almost all of the Arabs simply didn't believe him. They said it was insincere. He doesn't really mean it. He's just saying that to placate the United States. Now there's sort of a I told you so attitude, and I think they will concentrate their efforts in the international forum, in resolutions at the United Nations, in the Security Council, possibly the General Assembly, and other relevant international bodies to try to get a state established or imposed in that manner. And it's going to make it much more difficult for the United States to do what it has always done, and that is represent and defend Israel's interests at the UN and other such bodies.
Even long before this election, though, Ambassador Martin Indyk said he found no way in which there could be forward movement in the peace process because of the divisions within the Palestinians and the fact that no Israeli leader appears to be able to hold any kind of government together if they go down a road that might in any sense address final status issues like the status of Jerusalem and the territorial issues associated with the right of return, these kinds of things.
Well, that is true. The two-state solution has been a subject of much criticism, valid because we've been at it for decades. Many presidents, many secretaries of state, many Israeli prime ministers, many Palestinian leaders, and it hasn't yet been achieved. The problem is that no credible alternative has been presented, no alternative that offers any kind of a resolution to the tensions and the conflict in the region. And I think it's a region that's becoming increasingly dangerous, not just for Israelis and Palestinians, but for all the people there. As we know from the daily news, there are many overlapping, intersecting, contradictory conflicts going on in the region, and there is not a person on earth who can tell you for certain what would happen if violence erupted, how it might leak into overlap with, conflict with other conflicts in the region. So there's a great interest, I think, particularly in this volatile region now, to try to do something to tamp down the potential for an outbreak of violence.
But what do you think of this read of the Israeli election? And again, we respect the democracy, and we also respect political pragmatism. And you're someone who knows what political pragmatism is all about. It seems that perhaps the most generous view of Benjamin Netanyahu's statement here is that, look, I'm just not going to deal with this. I'm going to spend the next 4 years parked in place here in Israel right now. It'll be for someone else to deal with the two-state solution. I'm just going to hold the fort down for the next 4 years. Is that practical?
Well, I think holding the fort down will take a lot of action because, as I said, I think the Palestinians are going to go to the UN. Just, for example, consider this scenario, which I know they've considered. They take President George W. Bush's speech in Jerusalem. They put those exact words into United Nations resolution supporting a two-state solution, which, of course, is a subject of favorable approval by the UN on many previous occasions, and they put it up for a vote in the UN. What is the United States going to do then? We've consistently defended Israel. We, 3 years ago, when they put up a resolution on settlements, even though it was consistent with our policy, every other country supported it in the Security Council, Britain, France, all of our allies, the United States vetoed it. That will become increasingly difficult when you deal with an issue as fundamental as whether or not there should be two states. But I think notwithstanding that, we have to move forward. We have to do what we can to encourage the parties. They have to talk because they have commerce. They intersect at thousands of points daily throughout the region. We have to try as best we can in very awfully difficult circumstances to reduce the potential for violence and to try to channel the energies that are now very negative in the region into more constructive paths.
Senator George Mitchell, former Middle East envoy for President Obama from 2009 to 2011, this is The Takeaway. So, Senator Mitchell, let's hear what that would sound like if the Palestinians actually take George W. Bush's language to the United Nations. This is his speech in 2002, a little different from the one that you referred to, but the tone, I think, is the same. Listen.
It is untenable for Palestinians to live in squalor and occupation, and the current situation offers no prospect that life will improve. Israeli citizens will continue to be victimized by terrorists, and so Israel will continue to defend herself. And the situation of the Palestinian people will grow more and more miserable. My vision is two states living side by side in peace and security.
If the Palestinians take that to the UN, the U.S. basically has no option, right, but to support it.
Well, I'm not sure of that. I think right now it's likely that in the White House and the State Department, people are trying to figure out what to do and probably drafting alternative statements, one if we decide to support it, one if we decide to veto it. It puts us in a very awkward and difficult spot in this circumstance. We faced it, although not as awkward or difficult, as I mentioned, in the settlements issue a couple of years ago, and we did veto it, although it was somewhat embarrassing, but nonetheless we did so. I don't know what the administration will do. You can't view these things prospectively in isolation from the other events occurring in the region. For example, as we all know, right now we're coming up to the deadline on Iran. What happens there is going to have a dramatic effect on U.S.-Israeli relations, good or ill, how the Iran thing turns out. We're fighting ISIS. We're opposed to Assad in Syria. We have Iran coming in to help Iraq against ISIS. We don't like that, although we don't like ISIS. And we're meantime negotiating with Iran is very, very complicated. And I don't think you can say right now that 6 months from now we would do X or Y. It would depend upon the context in which it occurs. All of the region has to be taken into account because American policy affects virtually every part of the world.
Rashid Khalidi at Columbia University argues that the principal problem in the Middle East peace process is that the U.S. in fact acts like it's a mediator but really is actually doing Israel's bidding in every step of the way. How do you respond to that?
Well, I know Professor Khalidi. I know him quite well, and he's a friend, and I have a high regard for him, but I don't agree with him on that. It's based on the premise that if we are friendly with Israel, we can't be interlocutors or mediators. I don't think that's true, because at the same time that we are friendly with Israel and we defend their interests, we have emphatically said, President Bush just said, as you quoted, that in order for Israel to get security, there has to be a Palestinian state. Stated another way, Israel wants security, the Palestinians want a state. Neither can obtain their objective by denying to the other its objective. And so I think we can and provide assistance. We do provide tremendous amounts of financial and other assistance to the Palestinians. I spend a great deal of time in the region going around to other countries trying to get them to contribute to the Palestinians. So I respectfully but strongly disagree with Professor Khalidi in that regard, although I have to say that's the perception certainly in the Middle East, mm-hmm. that the United States does Israel's bidding and therefore it can act as a neutral interlocutor. It does reflect general popular opinion there, although I happen not to agree with it.
I can't resist one last question before we go. You can remember a time that both sides thought that the settlement issue was going to be the easy issue to move forward. Why has that not proved to be the case, a freeze in settlements by the Israelis?
It is not the only issue. It's one of many very difficult issues, but it has assumed a significance far beyond the reality on both sides. There is a legitimate argument to be made by the Palestinians that the continued building of settlements in what is the West Bank called disputed territories by most of the world, called occupied territories by most of the world, disputed territories by some in Israel who favor complete expansion and annexation of that entire area. I argue to the Palestinians that, look, they're building every day. That's what you're complaining about. Well, the way to do this is to get into negotiations, reach an agreement on the border as soon as possible, and we will push that hard. And once you reach agreement on a border, then you can build what you want on your side of the line, and they can build what they want on their side of the line. But continuing delay, waiting until the perfect solution comes along, that they just completely stop all construction before you'll begin to talk, is not an act of self-interest. It's contrary to your self-interest. Unfortunately, I was not able to persuade them in that regard. And, of course, today the settlements continue. Mm-hmm. My hope is that the Prime Minister will feel in a position of sufficient strength that he will limit new construction to the urban areas that are likely to be included within Israel. There are large what they call blocks that in which there's a dense concentration of population that lie fairly close to the line. And there's a widespread assumption, which I share, that in any ultimate settlement, the border will be adjusted to include those in Israel. And if he limited construction just to those areas, it would not have the same very negative effect in the Arab world. It'll still be negative,
right,
but it will not be as otherwise.
We are very grateful for your time, Senator George Mitchell, former Middle East envoy for President Obama from 2009 to 2011. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The NCAA men's basketball tournament is going to get you fired. That's right. If you're doing brackets at your office and trying to follow all of the games, 16 games taking place each day in the first round, you're not going to get much done. So what if you had a trusted friend who could watch the games for you and tell you when it's time to watch, alert you to those last three-minute nail-biter moments, huh?
3, 2, 1, zero's on the clock, and this game is over. We have witnessed college basketball history.
Well, that's why the wizards at WNYC Digital built an app to help us all out. It's called the Nail Biter Bot and notifies you whenever a game is down to the wire, and you should drop everything and get to a screen for just a few minutes. Coder, designer, bracket maniac Noah Veltman is with me. He's part of the data news team at our co-producers, WNYC. Hey, Noah.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
This is a clever idea.
Yes.
I love it.
Thank you.
I mean, are you a big NCAA fan? Does this satisfy a need in your own life?
It definitely satisfies a need in my own life. I think In earlier years, I was more able to drop everything and spend all day watching these games. When I was in college, it was easy to skip class and spend 8 hours in front of the TV. Now, with greater work responsibilities, something like this comes in handy more. And it actually came out of one of our colleagues, WNYC's Jim O'Grady, complaining, walking out of a meeting before last year's tournament, that he wished he had a way to know when he should drop everything, stop working, and turn on the nearest TV.
All right, so the idea here is that when a game's getting close, getting to be must-watch, you alert people in their email.
So we alert people via a Twitter account.
Right. Okay, great.
Yeah, and when a game is within the last 3 minutes, there's sort of a sliding scale depending on what the current margin is and how much time is left and where we make the determination. This game is still close. And then we send out a tweet, which you can get notifications for on your phone if you use the Twitter app.
Now, this is all based on close games?
Yes. So if the score is within 8 points, 3 minutes to a minute and a half left, or it gets a little closer after that, within 4 points in the last 30 seconds, yes.
Now, this particular year, though, there could be a lot of different versions of nail-biter games, right? I mean, if you had Kentucky suddenly down by 10 points in the third period in any game, people would have to drop anything.
Oh, sure. There's certainly a difference between close games and games worth watching.
Yeah,
Close games are generally very exciting to watch, but there are games you might be interested to watch for a different reason, like if Kentucky was somehow getting clobbered in the first round, which I think everybody would gather around the TV to watch that.
Things would stop. Things would certainly stop in the state of Kentucky. The NCAA really lends itself to this because it's not like a best of seven series.
Right. Yes. It's not something like the NBA playoffs where you have four rounds, best of seven each, and it takes 2 months. It's a very long process, and although the playoff games are exciting, the game one or game two in the first round of what is going to be this long slog is not necessarily as exciting as these tournaments where every single game is loser goes home.
And the free throws can be completely decisive. Anything going on in the fourth period can be completely decisive.
Yeah, any free throw, any controversial call by a referee, it can always come down to these split seconds, these moments, these individual plays.
And is this up and running now?
Yeah, it's up and running. It's ready. The tournament actually started on Tuesday,
right,
with the first two games of the first four, the play-in games. The first full round is today. And it will also be tweeting the women's tournament, which starts tomorrow on Friday.
Noah Veltman, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And what's the name of this bot?
It's a Nailbiter bot. You can find it on Twitter as Nailbiter bot, or I believe there's a link on the WNYC homepage.
Thanks, Noah.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
If the power went out in Austin, Texas this week, the South by Southwest music techies would be reminded that their annual Burning Man Utopia of Planet Hipster is dependent on some very old and unhip technology: fossil fuel power plants, diesel backup generators, and batteries. The technology for which is decades old, with few exceptions. Even the latest mobile devices rely on batteries that are innovative only in their shape and incremental efficiency. Every whiz-bang prediction about tech at South by Southwest is dependent on the battery entering the 21st century. Journalist Steve Levine's book about the race to find a battery breakthrough is called The Powerhouse.
It's really where the tire hits the road, if I can use that language.
Well, if you're a Tesla, that's the case.
Yeah, it's the difference between having electric cars in the mass market. It matters in terms of our smartphones, our iPads, but also in terms of our electricity supply. It looks over the next few years, like a lot of us may have a large lithium-ion battery in our home, cut our electricity costs into one quarter of where it is right now.
How close are they?
I think we're going to have a big shift, a big inflection point between 2018 and 2020.
It seems to me that the battery problem or the limitations on the battery is also a potential limitation for wearable devices like this Apple Watch, that if it can only really stay charged for about 8 hours, you're going to wake up in the morning and it's going to be wrong.
Apple is staying strangely silent about the longevity of its watch. You notice that the iPhone 6 Plus is going for a whole day, but that's because it's so big. The Apple Watch is so small that what they're going to have to do is somehow make us take a mental shift about what a watch is and how you wear the watch, what you do with the watch during the day. You're going to have to probably take the watch off and put it into a charger. I think the jury is out on whether the watch is going to be as successful as Apple's other blockbuster inventions.
And, leave it to Apple. If you can't redesign or re-engineer the device, you just re-engineer the consumers.
Well, that's right. Hey, but Apple has made a big bet right now. It looks like it's come into the electric car space. So up until now, we've seen Tesla make electric cars cool, but it's been alone in terms of being able to validate the electric car. Nissan is out there with the Leaf, GM is out there with the Volt, but those don't sell really well, and that's because people are buying them just to be green. When you want to be cool, you spend $70,000 or $100,000 on the Tesla. If Apple comes in, which it looks like it is hired hundreds of battery engineers away from other battery makers and looks like it's hiring experts from car makers too. If Apple comes into the market with the Titan, that's the name of the car that it's working on, it is really going to be a tipping point, I think.
What's the most disruptive, holy grail kind of discovery that would really turn things around? Is someone looking for that? And does everybody understand, kind of like fusion? If you could do that, you'd solve all the problems at once?
Sure. There are way out there, far-fetched ideas. One of them is a thing called lithium air, where you remove a bunch of the heavy, cumbersome parts of the batteries and literally use air as your electrode. That really is like fusion. But a more realistic idea that's out there that really could happen is figuring out how to use pure lithium metal. Right now, the battery scientists use a little bit of lithium in each of the battery cells. But what if you could put pure lithium metal into the battery without it catching fire, right? When lithium comes into contact with the air because of the moisture, it ignites. If you can figure out how to put powerful, pure lithium metal into the battery, which is being studied right now as one of the holy grails, you would get all the way there. You would have your super battery. The electric car would be able to sit side by side in a showroom with a combustion car and compete on price.
Steve Levine is the author of The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. In civil lawsuits, it is normal for settlements to end up for far lower dollar amounts than plaintiffs were originally going for in damages. But when the civil suit involves a governor and possible campaign contributors, oh, by the way, and a governor who is a potential presidential candidate, the numbers get a different kind of scrutiny. A $9 billion lawsuit against Exxon to clean up chemical contamination in the state of New Jersey was settled by Governor Chris Christie for a fraction of that, $225 million. Is Christie doing Exxon a favor? Well, this week, the New Jersey State Senate approved two measures designed to revoke the settlement, which, like the Exxon pollution at issue in the case, stinks, according to some New Jersey lawmakers.
I had a hard time living with the smell coming out of the petrochemical companies in Exxon when I grew up in Bayway years ago, but this smells even worse.
That's New Jersey State Senator Ray Lesniak speaking to CBS Radio. Bob Henley is the political analyst for WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. He's also a regular contributor to Salon and City and State. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks for having me, John.
Great to talk to you again. So how does this settlement really have a different level of scrutiny than maybe other settlements might have?
Well, first of all, it's not fully resolved. As a practical matter, it was brought in state court, and there's a 30-day comment period that starts next month. And at that point, the Department of Environmental Protection, who is sponsoring the comment period, assesses the comments, reports back to the judge, and the judge at that point can make a decision to sign off on it. It is getting scrutiny because the state, going back three governors before Governor Christie, litigated this thing for over 10 years. And John, here's the thing, spent $100 million in expert witness fees and had already gotten to the point where liability had been determined. And literally at the last minute, the state signaled the judge there had been a settlement, and they were looking at a minimum at $3 billion. What we call natural resource damage claims. This is the concept in law that wetlands and saltwater marshes belong to the public. It goes back to the Magna Carta, and that when a company like Exxon has despoiled it for over a century, there's a price to be paid because the public lost the use of it through contaminated fish and a compromised ecosystem.
Can't Governor Christie make the argument, well, hey, the tobacco settlements were much less than they originally went for, and that was all about getting the money in the hands of people who could use it during the times that they're alive, and hey, we're getting money to the coffers of the states of New Jersey, and Exxon has lawyers up the yin-yang. They can delay this forever.
I'd say that, except we have the precedent of the BP oil spill, where a properly prosecuted case did produce some significant benefit. I think also it's a little bit different because what Governor Christie has been doing, he did in the past last year, was to take anything above $50 million from these natural resource damage claims and put it directly, as you say, into the general fund and not towards the toxic remediation that's required. That means it's kind of pimping off of the damage that's been done and leaving that work unresolved and not finishing up what you've committed to do. I think it's also
So it's two crimes in terms of politics. One, you're giving Exxon a deal, and number two, you're using the money to solve your budgetary problems, not the environmental problems.
Right. And this also comes at a time that's critical for this ecosystem, the Newark Bay. The public in New York and New Jersey, because it's a shared bi-state estuary, has invested billions of dollars in sewer plants that have brought the dissolved oxygen back up. We could see the restoration of a major fishery if we resolve these hotspots right. And there's a second piece that's critical. In the age of austerity from Washington, post-Sandy, we know that we need to restore these saltwater marshes and freshwater wetlands as a resiliency against the rising sea level that's well documented and against another Sandy. This is something you can't pass up when we know the federal government is not going to be funding these kinds of serious resiliency requirements.
Taking Sandy out for just a moment, is this a bigger deal in terms of Christie's presidential aspirations than just some fishermen and kayakers in the estuaries?
Well, I think if you take it in combination with the fact in Iowa, he's really missed the test for taxpayers by backing the ethanol subsidies. We see a pattern here. You have even someone like Ted Cruz, a senator, conservative, at least being consistent in going to Iowa and taking his lumps and saying this ethanol thing is a hidden subsidy for agribusiness. And in some ways, he's in line with environmentalists who say this business of using corn as a way to as part of the fuel to drive our motor fleet is a disaster for the environment. So you see Ted Cruz taking the morally consistent position of being against it in Iowa, whereas Christie fully embraces it. It's almost like he plays to whoever has the most money in the room at the time.
So Christie has not really figured out a broad vision of whatever his sort of political record is going to be in terms of criticizing him in the political campaign. He's basically just following the money.
Well, exactly. And the other thing here is that his one claim to fame, he did have a moment. In 2011, New Jersey did stand up to a long-standing problem of underfunding its public pension. For years, the government had made increasingly larger promises to its public workforce and not funded the pension plan. He did manage to get bipartisan compromise. Public workers raised their retirement age, kicked in more money. The piece he had to bring to the table was finally doing what other governors hadn't done and fully fund the state's contribution. He walked away from that, and that is his really only claim to bipartisan accomplishment, which he reneged on, and the National Press Corps still hasn't caught on to that one.
Do you think Christie is vulnerable to attack ads which say friend of Exxon, which say didn't fund the pensions, which say follows the money and doesn't have a consistent vision as far as the things he's done as governor of the state of New Jersey?
Yes, and he's also very vulnerable to the thousands of households from Sandy who have not managed to get back in their homes. This was another signature accomplishment, and they showed up in Iowa. These people have still been homeless all this time. So he is vulnerable. He's just got to keep running and keep the showman part of his persona up front, because the substance part just isn't there.
What does he say about all this?
He basically is such a powerful personality. And in real time, he gives people a sense of being heard. But you have to follow up very closely to see that there's no there there.
Well, it's early yet.
Yeah, it is.
Bob Henley is the political analyst for WBGO in Newark. He's also a regular contributor to Salon and City and State, assessing Governor Chris Christie's vulnerability regarding a settlement with the Exxon Corporation for chemical contamination in New Jersey. Thanks so much, Bob.
Thanks.
The Takeaway is supported by ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at shopkeep.com.
We interrupt this virtuous public radio program to contemplate some bad behaviors.
Need a little time off for bad behavior. The devil in me done been asleep too long.
This is Carissa from Stillwater. I sucked my thumb until I was 13. Oh, the braces I got. I quit on my own after everyone quit bugging me about it, and I sometimes wonder if I would have stopped sooner, if they'd quit bugging me sooner.
Carissa, we're not going to bug you, but one of you in Tacoma, Washington is very annoying. I always seem to think I can do one more thing before I leave to go somewhere. This bad habit often causes me to be late. No, I've not been able to completely break my bad habit. Yeah, let's hear from some of your much-abused lunch dates, pal. From Beverly Hills, California, cracking my knuckles. Once I do one, I can't stop. And I crack all the joints in the fingers, too. Church, work, movies. I can't help it. I can't help it. I can't help it. I can't. Stop it. Just stop it.
Hi, my name is Ethan. I'm from Owatonna, Minnesota. Smoking would be my habit. I have been able to break it in the past when it was necessary to do so. But I always end up starting up again. I think my biggest problem is that I actually enjoy the act of smoking. It's not just about the nicotine. I know it's bad for me. I absolutely know I should quit. It's just all about getting past my own personal mental barriers.
The mental barriers are, in fact, a thicket of rationalizations and rewards. You stop doing something bad, and unconsciously you may make yourself eligible to do something else, well, not bad, but indulgent. You reward yourself. For instance, behaving virtuously about the environment may unconsciously give you permission to do something that could nullify the benefit of your original good instinct. Focusing on the simple act of bringing your own shopping bags to the grocery store, Harvard professor Uma Karmarker and professor Brian Bollinger from Duke recently published a paper called BYOB, How Bringing Your Own Shopping Bags Leads to Treating Yourself and the Environment.
Well, we actually found, because we were able to access some terrific transaction data when we were both grad schools at Stanford University, that happened to track whether people brought bags on any shopping occasion. And we found that on the occasions that people brought their grocery bags compared to the same people when they didn't bring their grocery bags, that you were more likely to buy organic versions of products and you were more likely to indulge yourself.
So what do you think is going on there? So people grab their bags, their green shopping bags, and they go, oh, aren't I a wonderful person? And they head in thinking of themselves as this organic, healthy person when they get to the store. And then all of a sudden, something else creeps in, Uma?
It's not even clear that they're thinking about it that consciously. So there's a whole series of research, and different studies lock into different parts of this. But we specifically sort of focused on the idea of licensing. That is, you make one decision that does suggest or show, particularly publicly, that you are a virtuous person. You are that good, green person who's doing the right thing by the environment. And previous work has suggested that this potentially even unconsciously sort of licenses you or allows you to then indulge in a subsequent decision. Now, you could think of this in a couple of different ways. So, for example, you could think of the people who really restrict what they eat during the meal and then splurge on dessert, and that might be more conscious. Here, we think that people may not even be consciously recognizing that they're doing this, but they've done this virtuous act, and they sort of have this awareness of having done something virtuous and good for the earth and good in general, and that consciously or subconsciously lets them reward themselves with a cookie.
Would you say that, you know, the way that we treat the environment is also the way that we treat people in a humanitarian sense, and that environmentalism just happens to be a pretty visible characteristic?
I think it's fair to say that there are some linkages. So there's a really interesting study done by Nina Mazar and colleagues where they had people make decisions that included more organic or environmental decisions. So they gave them an opportunity to make choices that demonstrated that they were buying more organic stuff. And those people felt licensed to behave in less truthful ways afterwards. So if you had bought more organic stuff or been exposed to the opportunity to make environmental choices, you felt, again, licensed to maybe cheat a little bit or make less virtuous moral choices afterwards. And if assuming it's from the same, stemming from the same place, that suggests that these are, you know, you're trading in the same currency, that environmental choices are seen as moral choices similar to lying or not lying to someone or cheating on a task. So it's entirely possible, I think, that these two things are seen, are coming from the same place or similarly, at least in terms of how they affect our behavior or how we see ourselves behaving sum total. I think the tricky part in terms of environmentalism is to figure out whether we can bring that awareness to people in terms of making active choices. So as opposed to a goal or an influence, can you really consciously be aware of or think about the environment as an active thing in your daily life?
Which is certainly something worthy. Brian, is there any sense in your research, Uma referred to currency. You must have seen some anecdotes here. There must be some indications of people rationalizing, you know, purchase of some indulgent product based on, you know, the use of some, you know, green bags just in the course
absolutely.
Of your research.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when Uma and I talk about this research to our friends, I have gotten countless replies about, oh, I completely do that when I remember to bring my bags. Like, you know, I'll buy the Girl Scout cookies outside the store or I'll get some extra chips or something like that. So we've had many people say that this is actually a conscious decision for themselves, although we don't want to say that it's conscious for everyone. So anecdotally, we definitely see that this behavior is there. And it's one thing that not being a consumer behavior researcher like Uma is, being more of a quantitative researcher, I thought it was fascinating that you find these effects across domains. So for me coming into the project, if I went to the gym, it's clear that maybe I would feel licensed to reward myself with a cookie. But having the fact that I brought a grocery bag have that same effect, I thought was pretty cool.
But Uma, it sounds like the makers of chips and cookies have some pretty positive news in some of your research, perhaps in theory.
Potentially. I think one of the totally fascinating things to me, too, is we're confident that people are indulging. But one of the things that did pop out in trying to get a better sense for how people felt about it was how broad the definition of an indulgence was. And so definitely we focused on things like cookies and chips, exactly, dessert, ice cream, because that's pretty unambiguous to pretty much everyone. But depending on the individual, a bit like Brian said, you could indulge in a particularly nice steak. You could indulge in an extra 5 minutes in the sunshine later that day. And that might be the indulgence that fits that individual. So I think the cookies and chips people could definitely pull something from it, but so could others.
Well, this is why we need to get more anecdotal information from the people listening to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And they can, of course, post comments at thetakeaway.org. And we are happy to share our data with you guys. I mean, it's totally unscientific, but if you're interested...
we'd love it.
All right, we're happy to send it to you. Uma Carmarker and Brian Bollinger, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you. What useful thing can you do with 110 fully loaded 747 jumbo jets in the form of tanks of absolutely pure water? A can of soda for every man, woman, and child in Mexico? I said something useful. Today, a new observatory using that much water goes online. The HAWK, the High Altitude Water Cherenkov Gamma Ray Observatory, begins looking at the universe from the top of a volcano in Puebla, Mexico. What does it do? It improves our awful seat in the cosmos for viewing the really cool exploding stuff like supernovas and black holes. It can detect electromagnetic radiation 15 times more sensitive than what we've had up till now. It detects TEV gamma rays, TEV gamma rays, which are the monster explosions in the universe. TEV gamma rays. Now you know. Impress your friends. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.